This is a test, Hiroshima. Only a test.
Hiroshima stopwatch. Hiroshima 302. Deaths, tourists do not sleep. Hiroshima 302. The night rains, drowned light. Hiroshima 302. From newspaper floor they stare. Hiroshima 302. A young girl smiles with no eyes. Hiroshima 302. Old woman sleeping, mouth open, cries. Hiroshima 302. Enter rich lady and sunglasses. Hiroshima 302. A large white man carries crutches. Hiroshima 303. Train jolts. Escape from time. Hiroshima 303. Fibrous white stairs. Soft radiant glow.
This is the 25th. All right. It's August 25th, 1998. Peter Bergman and Phil Proctor in Phil Proctor's studio here in Benedict Canyon, Los Angeles. And we're going to do a duo on the history of Proctor and Bergman, what this country needs. Okay. Phil, how did Proctor and Bergman get underway?
I don't remember.
I don't remember either. I do remember this. In 1973, the Firesign Theater was in somewhat of disarray. We produced a Not Insane, a kind of marginal album.
Well, it was at the most insane period of our existence together. We were going through some of the first paroxysms of personal change, having been together at that point for... What, it was 73, was it? So that means
it was 73. We'd been together since 66.
Yeah, a long time. And there were personal changes, divorces and suicides and, you know, the things that normally happen.
Not suicides within the Firesign Theater.
No. But around the Firesign Theater, which in a way is enough to throw fat on the fire. And basically, we reached a point where not only was the kind of the economic milieu changing in terms of phonograph records, but our own personal lives were beginning to change. We were of an age when we were going through, I guess, a pre-midlife crisis, right. Or, you know, so the normal things were happening that caused disruptions. And at a certain point, Peter and I had to kind of face the reality: are we going to go off on our own now? Because we made, in a way, some bad decisions, but there are no bad decisions. So we made decisions.
And we made them.
They were ours. We take responsibility for them. Whatever the decisions were, they have led to the release of this wonderful new album. So who cares? But in actuality, at the time, we didn't really know what we were going to do. We were kind of in a panic because we'd had this great success, and now suddenly, because of life changes, we didn't really know what we were going to do with ourselves. And Peter and I decided, since both David had gone up to Santa Barbara, and Phil was going through
a divorce,
since I've been through two of them, my heart goes out to him, and it did then, and it does even more now. It goes out twice as much to him as it did then, and so Peter and I found ourselves kind of thrown together with the feeling that, well, we're not going through any divorces right now, so maybe we should work together, and in order to carry on the Firesign banner in a way.
So we went to Columbia and we made an individual record deal with Columbia and turned out our first Proctor and Bergman album called TV or Not TV.
Yes.
Based on the concept that cable television was coming, and not only was it coming, but there was going to be a vast number of channels. In fact, we posited channel 86. Mm-hmm. We used 86.
85.
Channel 85? Was it 85? I thought it was 86. 85, huh?
I think it was 85 because in...
Because you couldn't get to 85 at that time. That was the channel you couldn't reach on your tuners.
Oh, I have to just add here, Fred, that this is the sad part about being as old as we are and having created as much art as we have. Shakespeare, I'm sure, had the same problem, you know. He probably said, much ado about something. He said, no, it was nothing. It was
much
nothing.
Ado much about null.
Much about null. No, it was nothing. Oh, yeah, right.
In any case, whatever. Any case, it was Fred Flam, portrayed by Phil Proctor, and Clark Cable, portrayed by Peter Bergman, two guys who ran a cable station out of their suitcase at home.
Yes, basically.
It was true pirate cable. And the whole album was various takes from this cable station. And then, not only did we make the record, but we created a vast vaudeville show. Mm-hmm. We put it on the stage and went out under the aegis of Northwest Releasing. What was his name? Dan Bean.
Yeah. Oh, was it Dan Bean who sent us out there? I'd forgotten.
Dan Bean sent us out. And sent us out, and we played about 10 dates with this huge vaudeville show.
Oh, yeah. It was a show that took, two trucks to transport?
It did indeed.
Oh, it was a big show.
We had dogs falling out of the...
The flies.
We had Japanese soldiers flying out.
Yes, they dropped a Japanese soldier.
We had a big screen
with, pre-recorded stuff on it. It was absolutely amazing. It was almost, in a way, too much too soon.
Well, now, too much... Let me give you the background. Too much too soon.
All right.
Proctor and I, around this time, doing our various promotions, ended up in a trailer doing a remote radio broadcast with Wolfman Jack. And there we were, crowded into this RV with Wolfman Jack. He puts us on the air with this: Proctor and Boygman, too much too soon.
Which
became our motto. And there were people pounding on the window as we were trying to be on the air with them, saying, Hey, Baldy, hey, Wolfman, hey, Baldy. Oh, it was people's theater. So Wolfman Jack really caught who Proctor and Bergman were. We were too much, too soon.
Too soon, it's true. All of that I kind of remember about the Proctor and Bergman years was this succession of shows that we did. And just like the Firesign Theater, we carried with us the energy of being able to write and create and memorize and stage and prop and costume these elaborate shows really at the drop of a hat. You know, we could do it almost instantly.
Well, I have to be honest here, Phil. I'm only going to be honest for this moment. I'm going to fake it. But
this is very important, Fred.
But propping and the costumes was almost entirely Phil Proctor's genius.
Oh, well.
It's true. One of the things I could count on, I was kind of the manager. I'd go out and kind of like get the managers and the gigs and the dates in a sense.
Right.
I was kind of like the business manager in a sense.
True.
Phil took care of the props and the costumes. We wrote together and we staged it together and performed it together. And we kind of shared all the other things. You know that we never, Phil, in the entire time that we are on the road, had anything that could be called a real fight?
No. The only fights that we ever had were over material. What worked, what didn't work, and that was
really... They were brief
and they were important because they were based on what we were presenting to the public and how the public responded to it. But I have to say, I mean, it's very kind of you to attribute to me
it's true, that
fact. But on the other hand, you actually lived on this street for a while.
Right.
And it was only because of the storage space you had underneath your house that we could do this.
Well, I can take credit for being
you
the storage space. That's kind of a vacuous metal to wear. But
hey, a vacuum is important, because nature abhors it.
Yeah, right. Well, whores abhor it, too.
Well, that's true, but you could always paint it red and put velvet
pillows. When's the last time you saw a whore working with a vacuum?
On this street, I saw a whore working with a vacuum during the
Heidi Fleiss lived on the street.
But
Fred,
that's another story.
This is
Heidi
off the record.
Heidi Fleiss's best friend's bodyguard's dog ate my bed. But that's another story.
But that's another story.
It is, and it's
true. It's a good album title. Heidi Fleiss's
best friend's bodyguard's dog ate my bed. It's true.
And it's
true.
I have pictures to prove it. Very X-Files. Very X-Files.
It is. It's true.
Key for
He can't get tight every night, pass out on the barroom floor. No, daddy can't get no fine cigar, but we know you're smoking wherever you are. Daddy don't live in that New York City no more. No more. No, 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 no.
Bob Guinea went off to Ireland to direct movies, and Irene Sue, who was then divorced and in the real estate business, rented his place to Peter Sellers' daughter, Victoria, who was working with Nash's then-girlfriend, Hollywood madam, Heidi Fleiss. As soon as Victoria moved in, our street was invaded by a boisterous group of partygoers of every race and color, raising hell at 3 a.m. It soon became evident that Victoria was running a little brothel business of her own a few doors away, and there didn't seem any way to shut it down.
The last time I was in Vegas, the strip was jammed with families and little kids, and everywhere I looked, there were ads for threesomes, S&Ms, M&Ms, you name it.
Well, don't be so quick to condemn, my friend. Every one of those hookers is somebody's daughter.
Yeah, it brings a whole new meaning to family fun, though, doesn't it?
Then, one afternoon, laden with groceries, Melinda and I opened our front door to be greeted by a panting pit bull. We let it out without incident and cautiously made our way through the house and into our bedroom. What we found there made us gasp out loud. My Scandinavian-style bed had been chewed to pieces, headboard and side panels reduced to slobber-soaked sawdust, and the heavy mattress displaced. It soon became apparent what had happened. The dog had chased our tuxedo cat Chester through the cat door. Chester had hidden under the bed, and the canine used his canines to try and get to him. I immediately stormed down the street and told Victoria to come see what had happened. And when she and the dog's owner, her young black bodyguard named Money, saw what his pet had done, he literally fell to the floor. They were very contrite and offered to pay for the restoration, but I waved it off and called Ginty's lawyer. Within the week, they were gone, and the story made national news on NPR.
So we turned out this vast vaudeville show around TV or not TV.
TV or not TV.
Then we did our second album.
Now remember, we also filmed TV or Not TV.
And we filmed TV or Not TV in the Fairchild Mansion in Long Island.
That's right. Steve Gilmore was our director at that time.
He didn't direct the stage show. He directed the movie.
Oh, he didn't. We directed the stage show.
Yes, we did. Yes.
Which was amazing.
People loved that show.
Yeah?
Well, yeah. I mean, if we'd gone on at that level, we would have been... you know, Penn and Teller.
But it was so expensive to do a show like that.
It was also over our heads in the sense that we were turning out a show too much too soon.
Yeah,
the show was bigger than who we were. We didn't come up through the clubs.
That's right.
We went back to the clubs after this.
Right. The Firesign Theater had established an identity, and Procter and Bergman were only half the wits of the Firesign Theater.
That's how we build ourselves.
That's right. And so to step forward and say, let's ride on the success that we've created as partners was it showed us that the Firesign Theater had this bizarre, unique identity, which it still has, which is like, how many of them are you? Yeah. Which is why we've been able to say there's four of us and then the fifth crazy guy. In fact, I remember one time, which we'll talk about later. I think it was at Ebbets Field when Peter and I went out doing a show
in Denver,
doing a show that was based on Firesign Theater material. And after the show, some people came back and said, where are the other guys?
As if they were on stage.
Yes. It wasn't like, you know, you guys, you know, where are the other guys? Why aren't they here? It was, we saw them on stage. Where are they?
Are they hiding somewhere in the That's in the right. dressing room?
It was amazing because of the quick change concept that we created with masks and pullover costumes.
And facial expressions and the state of mind of the audience itself.
We used a lot of Grotowski, which I love because his name is so grotesque. Grotowski is a Polish a theatrician and teacher who basically believed in no makeup. You just do it with your face.
Which is what we did. We never Absolutely. Wore makeup. We wore funny Japanese masks
yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah, half masks and things like that.
But everybody knew it was us.
Basically, we would buy a minimalist a change, a funny wig or a pair of glasses, very much like what we do with Firesign Theater when we perform. We would create complete changes of character, and it was really a psychedelic, a magic experience to do that kind of theater. I do miss having you know, doing the Firesign Theater with my partner Peter on a reduced level that was constant for us. It was an amazing experience, and playing in venues that varied from huge stages and college campuses to thousands of people to tiny little clubs where we were playing to like a couple of hundred people,
or in
smoking
the
and drinking.
Or in the case at my father's place in Roslyn, Long Island, the second show, we were playing to four people in a club
too.
That held hundreds.
But hey, I came out of a theatrical tradition where I was playing in Wind Gap, Pennsylvania to eight people, and we were on a two-sided arena stage, which meant that you had to play to the four people on stage left and the four people on stage right when you were doing The Boyfriend, you know. Right. Oh, yeah, good God. Oh,
so
yeah.
These things happen. We did a lot of clubs, a lot of clubs. We got a manager who booked us, sometimes rather creatively. Phil and I ended up in our various club
his
tours.
Name?
His name, oh, he was a linebacker for the Philadelphia Eagles.
Yes, he was a big
man. Trying to remember his name now. I'll think of it.
We had dinner with him at his house. Isn't this horrible?
He was a friendly man.
He was a very dear man.
But he was also a creative booker. We found ourselves being booked into the Playboy Club in Great Gorge, New Jersey.
Rising Gorge, New Jersey, as I called it. That was and what's his name? The wonderful comedian who did the Elvis imitation was there. They're going to do a movie about him now. Do you know him?
Now dead.
Yes, now dead.
The guy that wrestled?
Yes. Andy
Andy Kaufman.
Andy Kaufman was there, and I remember seeing just the end of his act. He was playing by the pool, outside by the pool. So he was there. If we'd only embraced him at that time, who knows what kind of a connection we could have had. But still, we were there.
We were there.
He was there.
And we were the lead act, and the woman that opened for us was going through the audience in diaphanous, see-through clothing, singing and having people join her in a female deer.
From the Sound of Music.
We knew we were in big trouble.
I had played the singing Nazi, Rolf the singing Nazi in The Sound of Music, and there she was singing Doe a Deer and getting these farmers to sing along.
Farmers, it was the underarm division from Gillette.
It was.
It was the Lawn Doctors Association of New Jersey.
It was.
We were in serious trouble. Oh, we came out at the Playboy Club to do our college boy act, and they booed us.
They hated us. Yeah, but they did. The
orchestra,
the band, we had a band on stage behind us, and they brought us on with Watermelon Man.
Watermelon
Man. And if they had some, they would have thrown them at us.
Mexico, they have an old theatrical tradition.
Oh, yeah?
Called La Palombra.
Palombra?
La Palombra. No. And it came out of the days when the Mexicans were a little more primitive in their life expression, their culture, and they used to celebrate by throwing money at, in the theater, in vaudeville. Good performers, they would throw gold and
that's
money.
That's an old tradition there.
Oh, yes, it is.
It's and a good old
they
tradition.
They didn't like the performers, they used to shoot at them. You
know? No.
Mm. Yeah.
No. Guns?
That seems fair enough.
Now, this has, of course, been modified. Theater is still very popular in Mexico. I just got back from doing a tour myself.
You did?
Yeah.
Did you tour down there?
Mexico? Sure. Yeah.
Look, let's talk about, we'll talk about that in just a second, but I'd like to hear about this.
Thanks.
What about
I would also like, I want to later get into the more religious aspects of the situation and the heart transplants and how they, you know, conform to this kind of reality. But first, I'd like to say something about horses.
Why don't you?
But let me get back to what I was saying, if you don't mind.
You didn't pick up any bad habits in Mexico. Or...
Yeah, I picked up a few, but most of them are just with a little repair will be as good as new.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Well,
and
how?
I got them
ahead.
In a monastery just on the other side of a nunnery, excuse me. It's now a monastery. It used to be a nunnery. Before that, it was a monastery and a nunnery, which is why it's no longer in existence. They had a little trouble there. Anyway,
the Palombra. Yeah.
Yeah, so today in Mexico, if you don't like a performer, you throw little pieces of lead at him.
See? Just pieces of raw lead?
That's just little pieces of lumps of lead.
Blom,
is it? Blom. And you throw, you put them in the, like, put them in a tomato.
Oh, well,
that... Throw it like that. Fishing weight seems like that. Put them in an onion. Now, the Palombra...
You must be able to get an incredible speed in a tomato with a lead.
Yeah,
right?
You can. And believe me, if a guy is singing and you don't like him, he knows it, you know. Oh, you know. And it's hard sometimes to tell the, you know, the... So anyway, the Palombra is a, the largest compliment, I might say, that you could pay to a performer. It's a sledgehammer head in a pumpkin.
In a pumpkin.
Inside. It's usually launched from the balcony.
Is there, I know this might be a silly question because you didn't get that deeply in the language, is there a name for the person who throws the Palombra from the balcony?
Yeah.
I know that in some of these rituals, sometimes people just get names for things. I don't know.
El Lancero.
El Lancero. Right. Does that translate at all?
Yeah.
It's Palombrist in English.
Palombrist. Oh, a Palombrist.
El Lancero.
Call a Palombra. No, that's...
The
that's
thrower is also
the thrower. What do you call the thrower?
El Lancero.
That's El Lancero?
Right.
All right, he has any, does he stand in a special place? Just anywhere.
His name is Hermilio.
Hermilio?
Yeah, if you really want to know him personally, you know. He's the master. He can heft about a 20-pound sledge head disguised in a pumpkin.
Why do they disguise it in a pumpkin?
Well, it's a tradition.
If it's a compliment, it's a compliment, right?
Well, it's an offhanded compliment. You know, if you are driven to this kind of reaction from a performer, you see, there's a certain compliment involved in that. Get off the stage! You know, we yell here in America. They're the more subtle. It's more like, and you throw.
It's a heavy compliment.
Like, right. And, you know, you either get him or you don't, but he catches on very quickly.
Right. Mr. Savat, let me ask you a question here. This may go over your head because you weren't there long.
What?
It must be difficult, particularly when people know a bad performance is going to go on that night.
It is hard.
It must be hard to watch and also to bring a 20-pound sledge and a pumpkin into the theater.
Oh, yes.
To the balcony. You know,
they sell them.
Is it a special?
No,
they sell them?
Of course.
They sell them.
Everybody knows that.
Good. You can make your own, as it were. Pick out a radish and a little piece of lead or, you know, a coin sometimes. This shows you how confused the tradition has become in the modern time.
Well,
coins, which used to be used exclusively for performances that you enjoyed, are now placed, five or six heavy coins, especially pennies from London. Pennies from London.
That's the English music culture.
Sharpen the edges of the mic.
Yeah, I was just demonstrating. You didn't really have to throw one of those at me. Well, they are now used hidden in tomatoes and pears and things to try, you know, and get them.
Look out! That is a Palombra.
That is
a
squash.
No, that's a winter melon, actually.
I have a recording.
That's a 15-pound
squash. Can I have a little bit of that, please? Could you have? Thank you. But I remember from that particular performance, everything that we did, I felt that what we were doing was high attitude bombing. Then, of course, in Nam, they were doing high altitude bombing. And I said to Peter, tonight was high attitude bombing. And I think that was one of the few arguments that we had. At the end of that, we went back to we walked past all of these bunnies, you know. And I remember the artificial plants there. Remember they had all these artificial plants where they had to dust? There was like nothing real at the Playboy Club.
We went back to our room. In our room, the carpet went all the way
up the wall. In case we sat there on the carpet.
It wasn't an argument. It was total distress.
We got to rewrite the entire act.
And we cannot appear in public tomorrow.
No, not until we do it. And we did. We rewrote the entire act, and we did something.
We didn't rewrite it. We resegmented.
Yeah, and we resegmented, and we also improvised.
Improvised.
Which was the only way to survive on the road.
And we did it. We got by.
We did.
They didn't like us, but they didn't hate us.
But they didn't hate us, and that was okay. There was a smattering of applause, which is enough. That's what matters, in a way.
And we actually opened for the woman. We told her that...
We said, please, we have to go first.
We have to go first, because after you, there's nothing.
Yeah. You're so strong, and you're so vibrant and wonderful.
Harriman was the name of our booker.
Len Harriman?
Len Harriman.
Len Harriman, thank God.
Former linebacker for the Eagles.
Poor Nancy, she's fainted. I'll just wrap her skirt around her head like this to keep her warm. And now I'll press her body close to mine to keep me warm.
She looked so helpless there, spread-eagled on the floor. I beat the eagle off and gave her a quick mouth-to-mouth resuscitation job. And then it struck me.
What a sap she had!